All right. Well, we are on to part two of our evening. And just a brief reminder, if you've enjoyed your time here tonight, please consider making a $5 donation in the little tin bucket in the back. If you need change, I can make that happen. That helps us cover the costs of travel for our speakers to come to these events and to make them happen, and possibly make them happen more often. And Tom Pixton has been lobbying me for a while to maybe do a full day of Sunstone sessions in Portland instead of Seattle. And I have to say that tonight's turnout is very persuasive in this way. So if you know of any possible venue that would be free or low cost in this area for a nonprofit to use, definitely give me a holler. I can give you my business card and phone number, and we can possibly work something out in future years. Our second speaker tonight is Dr. Richard Francavilla. He's a historian and geographer who's interested in how cultural attitudes shape the American West. He was recently chosen as the person who is giving this year's Arrington Lecture at Utah State University. And I went, and I pounced, and talked him into joining us for Sunstone tonight. Among his 10 books are 3 that address the important role played by religion in the West. And those are entitled The Mormon Landscape, Believing in Place, and Go East, Young Man, Imagining the American West as the Orient, which will touch on some themes that he'll speak about tonight. Although he is Professor Emeritus at the University of Texas at Arlington, he now lives in Salem, Oregon, which I circled on here thinking, pounce, pounce, where he actively conducts research for his consulting company, Geographic Designs, and he recently began teaching courses in religious studies at Willamette University. So he's in the area, and now he's on your radar as well as mine. So I will go ahead and have him begin his remarks on Orientalism and the Mormon experience.
Thank you very much, Mary Ellen. Thanks, too, to Marilyn Shauna for a beautiful home and a great company this evening, too. Wanted to mention that as I did my doctoral dissertation on the Mormons back in the Precambrian period, in 1968-69, I was doing innocently looking at the role of the Latter-day Saints in creating a distinctive landscape in the American West. But one of the things that kept on surfacing as I dug into the historical literature is how often the Mormons were equated with Muslims, or how frequently ancient Egypt or the Reformed Egyptian was mentioned, or those sorts of things that seem to have an interesting connection to the Middle East. And so I put those in the back of my mind as I became a scholar and worked over the years, and recollected more recently, about 15 years ago or so, perhaps 10 years ago, when I was teaching various courses in transatlantic history, one of the things that interested me very much as I came across not only the Mormons, but many other references to those things in the American West, like the Comanche Indians or the Paiutes or something, how frequently they were considered to be Bedouins or Mongolian tribesmen, or how often landscape features would be named after counterparts in other places. One of the sub-themes of my book not only deals with the Mormons in Chapter 3, this, by the way, is hot off the press, I think, as Mary Ellen knows, Go East, Young Man, Imagining the American West as the Orient, has two pictures of sexy reclining women on the cover, so we thought this might sell better than like a Mormon landscape or something. But there's a little sex. There's a lot of sex and violence and exciting things in this because the Orient itself is associated with so many interesting and tumultuous things in the popular imagination. And by the way, Mount Hood when you can see it occasionally here at this time of year. Mount Hood was frequently associated with, as was Mount Rainier, Mount Fuji. And the Kuroshiro current, you know, and bringing the vibes of Asia over and the Zen poets and so on of the Northwest. So I have two chapters that deal with the Pacific Northwest. That's a very, very shameless plug for my book. Recently published, it's just hot off the press by the Utah State University Press. In this presentation, I'm going to move fast through some slides and linger on some others. I just want to mention that the theme of how the Mormons were equated with and how they equated themselves with the Middle East and Middle Easterners is the subject of tonight's presentation. There'll be a much larger presentation or a publication resulting from this, the Leonard Arrington Lectures. I found out, by the way, Mary Ellen, some people have still not recovered from my lecture last month because I went so fast through it and introduced so many ideas, and students are still writing me about it in hopes of winning that lucrative prize in the essay contest. A little capitalism there is okay. And so so these are very enterprising students that passively aggressive.
They're aggressive.
They're aggressive, and they were after me at the end of that to get copies of my paper and that sort of thing. So very exciting. At any rate, I'm not interested in whether... I want to offer a new way of interpreting the Mormon experience, with some aspects of the Mormon experience. I'm not concerned whether Mormon beliefs are true or false, but rather how these beliefs contribute to Mormon identity, as conceived by both LDS folks and non-LDS. Address aspects of Mormon history that are controversial and sometimes considered off-limits. As you may know, Mormon scholars tend to avoid the subject I'm dealing with almost like the plague, many of them, because, somebody thought Joseph Smith wrote something in, Reform Egyptian or something like that. They're crackpots, don't even study that kind of stuff. But it's very interesting because it says a lot about the connection between the LDS folks and Orientalism more generally, American Orientalism in particular. Okay, so we can best understand the Mormon experience historically from around the 1820s onward in the context of American attitudes toward, paradoxically, the Orient.
Is that working?
I think so.
Okay.
Very briefly, the Orient was what? Any place east of Europe originally? Part of the equation that differentiates Western civilization from Eastern, them versus us, is today used for both the Middle East and the Far East. And in particular, I want to discuss the Middle East. By the way, the first known review, it wasn't published, but of the Book of Mormon, Shaker leader Richard McNamara said, looking into this curious volume, it reminded me of the Persian tales, which I used to read when I was a boy, and with which I was much delighted. A reminder that Near Eastern fables, fantasy literature, was embedded in American culture in the early 1800s. And McNamara used one of the qualities such of these tales, that they were fantasies, against Smith, one of the early detractors of the Mormons, and of course they had so many of them, and accepting what this inspired writer and dictator, that is to say Smith, took from the scriptures, that is to say the real stuff in the Old and New Testament kind of stuff, I suppose there was as much truth and reality in the one as in the other. In other words, you talk about passive-aggressive interpretations of somebody's gift, if you will. That is pretty embedded in that. Okay.
Too far.
Okay. Thanks. The Orient is, and this is a map of the Eastern Mediterranean and Asia Minor here, going off into India and so on, and it's configured by someone in the 1500s, a religious person, in this case, let's call him a Catholic, as this fantastic apparition, this Pegasus, and you see the map configured that way. It's fantasy on one hand, but it also says something about the deep nature, the embedded nature of fantasy in the culture about the East. Thank you. Part of the world I want to address tonight is basically right in here. Saudi Arabia, or Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula, Egypt, the Holy Land, and Persia. I think we'll get that down pretty well all now because
I'll keep watching your finger.
This is an interesting map. Rand McNally did it in 1884, and it basically shows a superimposition of the Old Testament world. It's got a biblical connection in part of the literature here that motivated this cartographer. But it shows the U.S. and the Old Testament world. We know it as a conceit or as sort of a fantasy, just a way of superimposing the size of the Old Testament world against a portion of the United States. But subliminally, this map does something. And as a geographer, I'm interested in not only real places, but places that are configured in the imagination. And what it does is it kind of boldly takes one part of the world and transposes it right on top of another part of the world. Well, this, in a sense, might serve as a metaphor for what the Mormons did in creating their religion in the New World, and also what other people did when they considered or they encountered Mormonism, because in a way it boldly takes the Old Testament world and superimposes it on the New. And by the way, that's what the Lamanites are all about, in a sense. The American Indians are really not American Indians at all, but what? Lost tribes of Israel. And so I'm going to move through here pretty quickly. Okay. A closer look at the Orient reveals it to be the source of the West's most deeply held, or many of the West's most deeply held values. Regarded with considerable ambivalence, and as a place where tradition and fate, rather than free will and progress, seem to control human affairs. Orientalism has three definitions, and you guys, you can read this, so I don't have to read every one of them, of course. But the third definition here interests me most. An imitation or assimilation of that which is oriental, especially in religious or philosophical thought or in art.
I think a lot of people can't actually read it.
Oh, they can't read it. Oh, thank you very much. Okay, then I will... Okay, so I will do my thing. I'll look here and get prompted and I'll convey it to you. Yes, would that...
Yeah, I'm saying I'll give a thumbs up.
Very good, thank you. Okay. Orientalism likely began in the classical period with Alexander the Great, played a role in the Crusades, gained new momentum in the Age of Exploration, okay, was a major factor in the rise of other European colonial powers, notably France, the ultimate Orientalists were the French, and England, circa 1750, and then appeared as a cultural phenomenon in the U.S., circa 1790, and moved westward with the American frontier. Now, Edward Said's Orientalism, how many folks have read his path-breaking book, Orientalism? How many folks have read? You haven't. Oh, okay, well, I'm surprised because Edward Said is very well known in the university crowd, and so most of my colleagues knew about him, and students knew about him. He claimed that Orientalism is a result of the Western minds needing to distinguish peoples and places that are different. In the Orient, we encounter the other. That's an astute observation. He said that Orientalism is very enduring in that it was both ancient and is also experienced in the present, for example, in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Another noteworthy observation. He, by the way, brought it right into the Middle East, and he brought it into the present, too, because he was a pro-Palestinian. He passed away a couple of years ago. He was a pro-Palestinian. Next. Now, another aspect of it is this invariably racist. Orientalism is racist because it casts Oriental people as inferior. It can, sometimes does, but this is overstated. By the way, I had to take on Edward Said when I wrote this book, and I'm still waiting for the other shoe to fall. It may fall on me, but I'm not sure. Orientalism is hegemonic in that it enabled the West to totally dominate the Orient, overstated and politically motivated, as Said's personal philosophy was, of course, basically anti-Israeli. So this presentation is post-Saidian, and because it recognizes Orientalism as too important and too complex to be simplified and demonized. That Orientalism is based not only on elite literary sources, which is most of the stuff that Said used, but also on other sources such as art, popular literature, travel literature, novels. I use, you know, modern movies, kung fu, postcards, as well as elite literature. Nuance so that it does not essentialize or oversimplify the West by generalizing about all Western countries, but also shows the West's admiration for and ambivalence about the Orient. We don't just despise the Orient, we're fascinated by it. We love it at the same time. Okay, so our Orientalism, derived from European, relied on other increasingly modern literary sources, such as romantic travel literature, and the Arabian Nights is a major source of knowledge, if you will. Sometimes it's perverted, but it's very interesting knowledge about the Orient. Okay, both old and new persist in popular culture, frequently involved applying metaphors from the old world to peoples and places in the new, and common tropes were Indians as ancient Asians, Near Easterners, or the Mississippi or Brazos or Colorado rivers as the Nile, that sort of thing. Okay. It's surprisingly persistent in American thought. You can see it in Little Buddha, the movie. You can see it in a number of things today. As early as Columbus's time, there was confusion about what and where the Americas were. Native Americans called Indians, everybody knows that, but they, of course, not really Indians at all. Many others, since his time, have imagined similarities, okay, between the Americas and the Orient. Above all, it reflects ambivalence toward the Orient, both negative and positive aspects. Next. And examples of this are, in the negative sense, in depicting that which was savage, corrupt, and despotic, observers would brand American Indians as wild Assyrian hordes and Mormons as despotic Muslim potentates. And these orientalized Indians and Mormons. Positive, in depicting that which was noble, wise, and exceptional, observers would claim that the American Indians were like those ancient tribes of the old world that represented freedom, Mark Twain suggested. And because they resisted colonization. A reminder that Orientalism can be subversive to the established order. Religion is a key component of Orientalism. Briefly, I just want to suggest a few ways that it might be, because Orientalism and religion both essentially deal with emotion rather than rationality, mystical rather than ordinary events, next, tradition rather than progress, immutability rather than change, certitude rather than relativism, centralized authority rather than participatory decision-making. Those are just some of the nuances that you can tease out of both Oriental mindset, the Orientalist mindset, and the traditional religious mindset. Okay, some examples then include the casting of these various migrations to the New World from England and other places as the crossing of the Red Sea in terms of the early American colonies. Portrayal of selected revered leaders as Moses, for example, George Washington. Did you know, by the way, that the symbol of the United States was going to be Moses parting the waters? I don't think the ACLU would have gone along with that one, so I just got the bird instead. But seriously, there was a lot of religious thought and Old Testament type thought in the American mindset. Extensive use of biblical place naming, Salem, Mount Nebo, Bethlehem, Hebron, Antioch, etc. Portrayal of certain Native Americans as peoples out of ancient biblical history. The ongoing search for the Garden of Eden, first as a metaphor for innocence and fertility, and then to endorse extensive irrigation projects in the American West. The garden is something that we've sought over and over again. The Spaniards, by the way, the first to orientalize the Americas, and of course we talked about the Italian Spaniard, if you will, Columbus, but as early as the 1520s, Pedro Martir de Anguera and others considered that the peoples of the Americas might be the lost tribes of Israel. Depicted the Garden of Eden in the New World, perhaps to suit the needs of the native peoples they sought to convert. Next. This painting from 1728 of the expulsion from the garden in Temepezalco, Mexico, depicts the Valley of Mexico, but and shows here Adam and Eve being expelled, and you can see the familiar geographic features. So in other words, the Garden of Eden is in Mexico City and environments. Next. From the 1820s to the 70s, it moved west with the Anglo-American frontier. And so we see, for example, biblical interpretations of the frontier experience, like Psalm 23 for Death Valley, the Arabian Tales, of course, the Arabian Nights, suggesting the wealth that could be obtained from mining the West. Egyptomania, the popular fad or obsession with Egyptian culture, has two incarnations in the early 1800s, stretching all the way to the present. But Pyramid Lake, for example, John Charles Fremont comes into the area in 1844, a few years before the Mormons got out to the West, and he names the pyramid feature, pyramidal feature in the lake, after the Pyramid of Cheops. And he even says, this is actually a better replica of the pyramid than the one that's in Egypt. And that makes the Nevada Chamber of Commerce probably feel really good. But that gives you an idea what kind of fantasies were running rampant.
And that was before Las Vegas.
That was before Las Vegas, and then in my book, by the way, I deal with the Luxor pyramid, and the new guise of Orientalism in the West. Okay. The Orient was a popular subject of interest in the 19th century. Many observers characterized both the Native Americans and the Mormons as Oriental in character. Part of a process by which the very peoples in the landscapes were Orientalized, again, another shameless plug for my book, Go East, Young Man. Go East, Young Man, by the way, is not only an inversion of the old mantra about the West, but actually Elvis Presley said it in Harum Scarum, just as he was entering his Las Vegas years, and it was his sexually charged fantasy about a young man going east where he can make love the way he pleases, have a harem and all that sort of thing. It isn't, it creates a Go East, Young Man. Okay, so I can't resist using Elvis as a the inspirer of my book title. Thank you very much. The statements were pondering. Generally, Mormons were depicted as a race among themselves, usually Oriental, so says Terrell Gibbons, sociologist, and caricature as containment, Orientalism, bondage, and the construction of Mormon ethnicity in 19th century American fiction. Sexy stuff, actually. Okay, next. In the 19th century and well into the 20th, Latter-day Saints were variously likened to Oriental, Asiatic, Turkish, and Mohammedan peoples. So says Jared Farmer, kind of a cool historian there, in Why the Book of Mormon, the Musical, is Awesomely Lame, in Religious Dispatches magazine, June 16, 2011. This hand-tinted image of Sir Richard Burton, not to be confused with Elizabeth Taylor's husband, but this is the real thing, back in the 1840s, Richard Burton knew the Asian world very, very well. He was an inveterate traveler, and he was absolutely an Islamophile. He just loved Islam and studied it and traveled to the Middle East, Near East, as it was called, on many occasions, and lived there. And so Sir Richard Burton visits the West, and the Mormon Church says, we have the great Orientalist among us, when he was there in 1859-60. Next. He wrote The City of the Saints, and Burton then used many Oriental references to the Plains Indians and others to say they were representative of Bedouin and other peoples. Next. The physical environment of Nevada, he compared to Afghanistan. The Great Salt Lake was, as he put it, an innocent Dead Sea. The cultural landscape of the Mormon West, said Salt Lake City was somewhat Oriental in appearance and largely built of sun-dried adobe common to all parts of the Eastern world. The Mormons were like the patriarchs of the Near East, most notably as Muslims and ancient Israelites. A review of the popular literature from the period, that 60 or so year period, reveals it was common to associate the Mormons with supposedly Oriental traits such as despotism, the tendency of one leader to wield power arbitrarily, mysticism, secrecy, symbolism, sensuality, including plural marriage / harems. Premise, the Mormons are in the right place at the right time to be Orientalized.
The place was the American frontier, witnessing remarkable flux, and the time, the early 19th century, witnessed widespread sort of passionate interest in the Orient among rank and file, a common folk. Another premise, this process of Orientalism or Orientalization worked both ways. In other words, the Mormons were not only Orientalized by non-Mormons, but they also Orientalized themselves. Next. Okay, so Burton's goal was to visit this thriving young religious center in Salt Lake City because he was fascinated by the Mormons. He's fascinated by religion generally, too, as many Orientalists were, or are. And so he just had to come through Salt Lake City on his way to California. And most of his book is about Salt Lake City and the Utah experience. And at this place, he tells us, Burton tells us, as he's overlooking the Great Salt Lake, the pilgrim immigrants, like the Hajis of Mecca and Jerusalem, give vent to the emotions long stored up in their bosoms by sobs and tears, laughter and congratulations, psalms and hysterics. By the way, he should know about this because he, Burton, disguised himself as a Muslim and traveled into Mecca, a no-no, because he wasn't Islamic, he was a Christian. And he traveled in there to actually experience what the Hajj was like, to get into the sacred city of Mecca. And not many people did that. It was a death sentence if you did, by the way, if you were detected. So, Burton had himself circumcised for fear that if he was caught, at least he would look like a Middle Eastern, which is to say either a Jew or an Arab or a Muslim at this time. And as one of my Jewish friends said, oy vey, you know, the guy's like, you know, like 35 years old. Okay,
it's commitment. That's commitment.
I should say, yes. Okay. Map of the world's religions, by the way, showing Christianity in this sort of bluish, purplish look, but then showing also Islam here, and then, of course, Buddhism and Hinduism. But notice this Islamic realm right here. And we're going to see, of course, that there's this connection between here and there as we move across the ocean. Okay, so, as I say, the church recognized him as the famous Orientalist, even at the time. And the term was originally used for anyone who studies the peoples, customs, religions, etc. of the Orient. It was a very respectable, very positive term until Edward Said came along and really gave it a negative meaning. As one of my students said, I think quoting or paraphrasing Bon Jovi, he gave Orientalism a bad name. Burton's credentials were terrific. A dozen languages, wide travel experience, excellent writing skills, culturally relativistic view, at least for the time, intense interest in the Islamic world, and bravery. I gave you the X-rated version here, but he was disguised as the pilgrim. As an Orientalist, Burton measured new places, like the American West, in terms of what he had experienced, used Oriental tropes, to characterize the area. And so he used Orientalism to differentiate, that is to distinguish one group of people from another, okay, to decipher, to help observers make sense out of unusual elements and call for further investigation, and to dignify by showing the specialness of things, people and places that are encountered. Observers could call attention to not only the uniqueness of what they experienced, but to themselves as authorities. In the popular press, the Mormon examples of Mormon-related Orientalism include occult rites based on mysticism and or magic. Seer stones kind of fascinate me. And there's a rich literature that connects seer stones back to ancient Egypt and Persia that may or may not be the real source. Again, I'm not interested in the real sources of stuff so much as the supposed sources of stuff. So, Mormon sacred texts written in Reformed Egyptian or derived from Egyptian sources such as the Book of Abraham. The Mormon belief that Native Americans represented the lost tribes of Israel. The Mormon belief that the Garden of Eden is located in Central North America. Mormons as peoples of the Old Testament and or Muslims. Specific items in the Orientalization of the LDS folks are Mormons in ancient Egypt, lost tribes of Israel, Mormons in Israel, that's to say Mormons as Israelites, Mormons as Muslims, and Mormons and the Promised Land. And I'll talk about these just briefly. Okay, so the next part of my presentation here, and I don't want to run over time here, but I think I'm okay. Mormons in ancient Egypt. Joseph Smith was intrigued by and had a deep interest in ancient Egypt as it pertained to religious truth. Hieroglyphics were considered the key to understanding ancient Egypt, mysterious rites and secrets. Smith's publication deals with, he has a publication on the importance of this. Smith obtained an ancient Egyptian scroll and interpreted as the Book of Abraham. When Warren Parrish reported about Joseph Smith, he said, I've sat by his side and penned down the translation of the Egyptian hieroglyphics as he claimed to receive it by direct inspiration from heaven. This is in 1838. By the way, at this time, the Rosetta Stone was being translated, if you will, grabbed from Egypt as part of the Napoleonic ventures there after 1798. And so Egypt was on everybody's mind. It had been in the Old Testament anyway. And now getting these artifacts and information really excited people. And here's Times and Seasons, of course, dealing with the Book of Abraham. And another view of that from the papyri. Okay, next. The Eye of Providence and other symbols suggesting Egypt and the Trinity also are very common in not only Masonic symbolism, but also LDS symbolism. A Deseret for the honeybee is said to derive from ancient Egypt. Deseret, the word, is considered to be that. It's said it was ancient, and along the Nile River, you see the reverence toward the honeybee as an important symbol, if you will, of life. And